This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. The Me Too movement, originally created by community organizer Tarana Burke in 2006, gained mainstream traction over a decade later in 2017, and has since grown to become a global movement of victims confronting their abusers and seeking justice. Despite the successful efforts of the Me Too campaign to increase awareness around sexual assault and harassment, survivors and survivor advocates say that there is still a significant amount of work to be done. In New York, August 14, 2019, marks the beginning of a one-year window for victims of child sexual abuse to bring forward allegations that might have otherwise fallen outside the statute of limitations. Supporters of the Child Victims Act see it as a model for holding past abusers accountable and allowing victims to pursue justice on their own terms. In April 2018, the Hinckley Institute featured a forum on the history and culture of sexual violence. The event was part of an effort to educate, raise awareness, and reinvigorate sexual assault prevention efforts. The panelists included Utah Democratic Representative Angela Romero, Utah Juvenile Defense Attorney Nubia Pena, and Rob Butters, professor with the University of Utah College of Social Work and director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center. Serving as a fill-in moderator for the beginning of the program is Dara Jones, a sexual assault victim survivor advocate for the University of Utah. This forum was recorded on April 11, 2018. The first question asked of the panel was how the Me Too movement affected what each do with survivors and the larger community. Answering first is Nubia Pena.
So at the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, although we do not provide direct services to survivors, so that would be the Rape Recovery Center. So if there was an individual that was a victim of sexual violence, they would be able to contact the Rape Recovery Center to receive direct one-on-one assistance. They would be able to call a victim advocate at law enforcement. They would have a SANE nurse, which is a rape nurse examiner, that would respond to the hospital and assist them as they receive the CODAR. What we do is we equip the individuals that work on the front lines, the first responders, to be able to have the training necessary in order to engage with survivors. What we've noticed after the hashtag MeToo is that there was an increase of requests from the community where they wanted to have a better understanding of what is sexual assault and what's the difference between sexual assault and sexual harassment. Now, what we need to understand is that the hashtag MeToo, as it's trending right now, is really about sexual harassment in the workplace. But the hashtag MeToo started by a woman with a nonprofit that wanted to advocate for survivors of sexual assault because of her own narrative. So even though Alyssa Milano made this trendy, this was work that was being done long before it hit Hollywood. And so I know that one of the questions that we'll come to in just a moment is, what are the shortcomings of the Me Too movement, is that it's really isolated voices that have been doing the work long before this became popular, and it has not really created an intersectional approach to doing this work. So it has not considered voices from women of color, individuals who identify as trans women and trans individuals who have suffered and continue to suffer this type of violence in their community and in their workplaces, but yet services are not quite equipped to be able to deal and address those things. So I don't want to necessarily monopolize the time, so I'll pass this over to Dr. Butters. But again, just keep that in mind. There is a lot of work that still needs to be done. So just because it's trending now, it doesn't mean that we have gotten to the place where the work is finished.
Well said. I think in my practice as a clinical social worker and working with survivors, what I've seen is the Me Too, hashtag Me Too, is sort of destigmatized people being able to raise their voices and talk about their sexual assault or sexual harassment. And it's given people an opportunity to come together with others. I mean, one of the biggest enemies of people healing from assault or violence or trauma is isolation. And it's allowed people to connect, whether it's social media or their friends or their family, and just forming this kind of solidarity around being victims and then having an opportunity to contribute to something that's important, a movement to end that, to raise people's voices and to give people an opportunity to, you know, talk about their history and talk about what needs to change. And so I've been inspired to see people raise their voices and do some of that.
And I would totally agree with that, and also with what Nubia pointed out. But when you look at Me Too systemically, you think, we're just going to use Utah statistics. So one in five children will be sexually assaulted, sexually abused before the age of 18. 90% of those individuals will, that'll be somebody in their circle of trust. When we talk about sexual assault, we talk about you know, workplace harassment's kind of been put in this. Majority of the time, you know, you're the person who is your alleged perpetrator. And the other thing is 86% when we're talking about children will not talk about this until, and even if they do talk about it, until adulthood. But what I've seen with the Me Too from an institutional perspective is that the institution is there to protect the institution. And I had this conversation with an AP reporter yesterday regarding sexual harassment in the legislature. And she's like, why do you think the numbers are low? And again, it goes back to the victim shaming and the victim blaming. And we can have that hashtag Me Too. But we've seen as we look at the newspaper, when somebody comes out and speaks out against somebody in a position of power, how that person is still shamed. And so I'm glad that Me Too has brought people together where they're able to talk about these experiences, but we still have to look at these institutional barriers if we really want to address this issue, because we could be saying Me Too again 50 years from now.
Thank you, Representative Romero. And that really segues quite well into the next question, which is that the Me Too movement is not beyond critique. We hit on a couple of those things, but I think critiquing it is extremely important, so we could probably delve into that a little bit more today. So we could start with we can talk a little bit more deeply into the shortcomings of the Me Too movement and maybe talk about how we can do better. And then also what we might be learning from the movement moving forward.
When we're talking about the shortcomings and how we can continue to really dive into what else needs to happen. So beyond hosting forums where people can come out and in solidarity share their story, beyond just being able to create a space where we're holding that space in safety and encouraging individuals to feel courageous that they can share their narrative, we also have to look at the policies and practices in our institutions, our school campuses, our workplaces, our offices, our nonprofits, our law enforcement. What's the culture that is currently existing? If there are individuals that feel harassed, do they feel safe in telling their individuals in their chain of command? Is there certain policies that are in place that not only are in compliance with what the federal law requires, but the state law requires? And is it also creating a zero tolerance policy that says this will not be something that is allowed in this community that we're engaging in? So we have to really encourage individuals to ask themselves, to reflect, where are you at? How is this conversation being had? Is it being had at all? So just for just to kind of get a pulse of the audience right now, raise your hand if since the hashtag MeToo was trending, you've had a conversation about sexual harassment and what your rights are under Title VII. Raise your hand. Look around. There's only a handful of you. So how many of you are aware that Title VII is where you can find sexual harassment in the workplace as a way of being able to know what your rights are? Raise your hand. Look around. Not many of you. So that is something that I'm just going to put out there right now. At the Utah Coalition Against Sexual Assault, we just created a sexual harassment in the workplace curriculum that we're hoping people will ask us to teach in their classes, in their schools, in their offices, because we want people to be equipped with the knowledge and the understanding of these are your rights. And if in your organization they are not abiding by what the law clearly says, then we need to be able to push for there to be a change in the culture. So my critique would be is that, yes, we need to have the narratives be able to be disclosed. We also now need to be strategic in how we change and shift culture.
And I would say that that also translates to Title IX at the university as well. How many of you are students here? Okay, excellent. Title IX is also the legislation and policy that the University of Utah operates under that has a lot of relevance to sexual misconduct and discrimination experienced by students and other university community members. So that's also something that needs to be looked at, understood, talked about.
And in 2017, we you know, working with all of you, we were able to pass HB 215, which is the campus confidentiality, so that now anyone who wants to report something has that confidentiality, and then it leaves them with that decision on whether they want to move forward. Every session, Representative Kim Coleman tries to add another layer to that, which would negatively impact survivors or people who want to report, because she would want institutions to automatically report that to law enforcement. And that's something of concern. She raises it every session she files that bill, and I wouldn't be surprised if she doesn't file it again this upcoming session for 2019. So just to have that on your radar.
you know, being aware of my positionality as a man, I don't know that I have some large critiques for the hashtag Me Too, except for I think it's unfortunate that it's become mostly a women's movement and it's perceived, and I think that allows men to just opt out of being concerned about this. I think that men are concerned about it, but the way that it developed and the way that it's talked about, men are able to say, well, that's something my sister or my mother or my friend is dealing with, and it's not my issue. And I think that that's unfortunate, because this is a human issue and not just a women's issue, of course.
I agree. And when we're thinking about that, too, we also have to think about how we all respond to it. Because I know women that are in positions of power, and when this particular, you know, someone's complained about harassment, are you sure? You know, and sometimes that can even be more harmful to the victim than it is coming from a male colleague. That's just my personal opinion. I want to put it out there. And so we have a long way to go. As I pointed out, this is all institutional, and it's really focusing on what can we do to prevent things so we're not going to Me Too. How do we talk about trauma? How do we deal with healthy relationships at a young age? And how do we define that so we're not even here talking about sexual assault and Me Too? Because many people don't even realize that they're violating boundaries because nobody's ever told them that. And so how do you educate individuals so that they know they're violating boundaries? You know, we've all experienced this, as I'm sure men have too. I mean, I think everyone experiences this, where you've told somebody, I don't like the way you hug me, please don't hug me. A year passes by and they still think they can hug you. Mm-hmm. And you constantly have to remind them. And so, you know, different people have different boundaries. And I think that's really important for people to understand. So everyone that hugs you is not trying to sexually harass you or assault you. And so it's really, how do you define that, your individual boundaries, and we as people respecting everyone's individual boundaries when it comes to right. that.
That's Angela Romero, Democratic Minority Assistant Whip in the Utah House of Representatives, speaking at a forum on sexual assault awareness and prevention, first recorded in April 2018. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are re-airing a panel discussion on the history and culture of sexual violence, given on April 11th, 2018. The event coincided with the Sexual Assault Awareness Month and was part of an effort to educate, raise awareness, and reinvigorate sexual assault prevention efforts. Speaking on the panel is Utah Juvenile Defense Attorney Nubia Pena, Utah Democratic Representative Angela Romero, and Professor Rob Butters with the University of Utah College of Social Work and Director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center. Moderator for the second segment is Dara Jones, sexual assault victim survivor advocate for the University of Utah. Here is Dara Jones.
The next question is, what are effective, and we can also talk about ineffective, ways for starting conversations around sexual violence? And I think talking about setting boundaries is really important, and the perspective of the person on the receiving end. But I think also I'd love to hear some perspectives on the talking about the experiences of the person who is giving the behavior that might be unwanted, what goes into that, like, in, you know, potentially entitlement or lack of being able to have these conversations, et cetera. Some other considerations, our college campus, and informal conversations happen between peers and with parents, and how can we make these conversations more approachable, so from the ground up.
I can start with that. I think this is this is where I hope this evolves into, is us having more honest conversations about relationships. I think how you start that conversation with people, I mean, as a therapist, it's all about sort of how we say things to people that's important. And so starting to talk about, to keep people from being defensive, if you start with, hey, you're sexually harassing someone or you're sexually assaulting someone, how you start that conversation is, how do you have a healthy relationship and what does that look like? And how do you monitor your boundaries and understand that boundaries are different for different people? And having that conversation about what is a healthy expression of sexuality and compassion and intimacy. You know, men are not socialized to understand that you can have intimacy without sex, right? And you can have a relationship with someone that is emotionally connected. And we're not having those conversations with our young boys, with our adolescents, with our adult men very much. And so I think we need to have those conversations in general. We need more comprehensive sex education so that we're starting those conversations early on. And I think that that sets a precedent so that when we do have to talk about these difficult, these assaultive situations, these harassing situations, we have a baseline for communication about sex and relationships and empathy and things like that.
What I really want to go back to is your conversation about how do we bring men into this movement, because it really has become, as the sexual violence movement has always really been, a woman's issue is what people like to say. But the reality of it is that when we look at the individuals that perpetrate, even though 2% of the population of men perpetrate, they are 98% of those who offend. And so we need to ensure that we recognize that the individuals that could prevent this is the individuals that perpetrate it. And so we need good men, we need all men to be able to engage in this dialogue and say, I will be the type of person that when I see behavior that is questionable, I will challenge it and I will intervene. So bystander intervention is a critical part of this conversation. We need to train individuals to know how to feel comfortable in challenging culture and behavior that perpetuates this narrative that sexual violence is justified and normalized. So we also need to consider, how do we change the dialogue so that there is no shame when we talk about sexuality? In our community particularly, we hate having conversations about sexuality because it's something that's very taboo. And yet there's a lot of studies that show that if you have open and informed conversations with your partner when you're engaging in intimacy, you have much more of a delicious experience, right? So, and you giggle, right? You giggle in your mind because you think, like, we don't openly talk about that. So I do a lot of presentations in high schools, and I do a lot of sex education classes. And when I'm engaging with these students, I ask them questions like, raise your hand, how many of you would ask for permission from your partner, boyfriend or girlfriend, to hold their hand? A couple hands go up. Okay, how many of you would ask for permission to kiss them? A couple hands go up. How many of you would ask for permission to put your hand in their pants? No hands go up. So what is it about the way that we engage in intimate connections with one another that makes us feel like we can't ask for permission? And they'll say things like, well, it'll ruin the moment. But what ruins the moment more? Thinking that you just had a great night, but the other person thinking that they were sexually assaulted, right? We need to be able to feel comfortable in having open dialogues, being authentic and transparent, and also being empowered in our own sexuality so that not only do we feel safe, but the other person who's engaging in one of the most important moments, for some, right? For one of the most intimate moments, that it feels safe and consensual.
And vulnerability, a vulnerable moment for many people.
I think they covered what I would point out as well, but really it goes back to the healthy relationship and distinguishing what consent is and what sex is. I think a lot of people don't, when we're talking about sexual assault, it's really about power and control. It's not about intimacy. And I think it's really important for people to understand the difference there. We were talking about child sex abuse. As I mentioned, I run a lot of legislation. My first major bill was HB 286, which was to provide child sex abuse preventative education in our schools. There are a lot of young people who are being sexually assaulted right now, and they don't know they're being sexually assaulted because that's all they know in their home. Or, you know, they know someone, they trust them, and that's their secret. And so how do we make sure that we're providing that prevention piece, again, at a young age, so people know that this is not norm, this is not healthy? And really, how do we define healthy relationships again? Because we all have a different take on what a healthy relationship is. I was a single mom, I raised my son on his own. That was a healthy family structure, but in some people's eyes, that wouldn't be a healthy family structure. Yeah, and so those are the conversations we have to have, that is not just this one narrative that defines what healthy is. It's everything in between, it's all that gray. And I think that's where we'll kind of have honest conversations about sexual assault as well.
And I think it goes across, you know, different sorts of relationships. So not And I'd love to tie this into, you made a comment earlier, Representative Romero, about healthy boundaries in all kinds of different relationships. So bringing this narrative into not just talking about your partner or sex with your partner, but talking about, you know, what a healthy relationship looks like with your friends, you know, between a teacher and yourself, where there are power dynamics present, it's always important to have these conversations.
Or even with family.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of people, when they think about intimacy, they think about it from a sexual perspective. But I think about my relationship with my mom. I'm 44 now, and I had to set boundaries with her at 35. And I have the best relationship with her now, because I had to set those boundaries. Do I communicate with her every day? No. Do I communicate with her monthly? No. But in order for me to be healthy as an individual, I had to change patterns. And so you can have abuse in relationships, in all kinds of relationships. And it doesn't, as we pointed out, it doesn't have to be related to sex. And so it's like, how do we define these healthy boundaries so that we're not passing that on to me, passing it on to my son or others around me, or putting myself in a situation like that in work? Because sometimes when you're in an abusive relationship at home, you accommodate people at work. And so there's so much to this, for just outside of talking about sexual assault.
Right. Okay. This question is going to be geared towards Dr. Butters. In your work with those who have perpetrated sexual violence, what trends have you noticed in their lives that reinforce rape culture or violent behaviors?
Yeah, I was thinking about the question before the panel, and I think we've been talking about power, right? And we've been talking about power differentials, and that's really what I see in a lot of these folks that are offenders of both sexual violence and domestic violence. They have this, they've been modeled, they've been taught, they've been socialized that that's what men do, that that's okay to do, and that's how you get what you want. And it's, and this is not to let these folks off the hook or make an excuse for them, but that's part of their psychology, is that they have just had this modeled. I've worked a lot with juvenile sex offenders, and one of the biggest risk factors for a juvenile sex offender is witnessing domestic violence in the home. So you say, well, what is you know, perpetrating against a sibling or a cousin have to do with witnessing domestic violence? Well, what that's about is that's about modeling control. What that child learns when they see that is, when you want something, you use your power and you use violence to get what you want, and you don't consider the what the impact on the other person is. And so it's really about, I mean, we're talking about sexual assault and sexual harassment, but I like that you've expanded that into a discussion of power and all sorts of abuses. What we see is that the serious and dangerous rapists and domestic violence offenders are actually exploiting people in a number of ways, and sex is just one of the ways that they're doing that. Those are the people that are taking advantage of folks in a myriad of ways, and sex is also one of the instruments that they use. And so, but I see a lack of emotional education. Most of these fellas, and it's mostly men, of course, the perpetrators, do not have a way to express vulnerability in a way that feels safe for them. It's a lot safer to create vulnerability or to exploit vulnerability. And so being able to, again, going back to how we make this a men's issue, I love the bystander movement. I mean, that's where you take offenders or people who are at risk of being offenders, and you have them stand up for the victims, rather than making it the victim's responsibility to prevent sexual assault. I mean, we did that as a society for a long time, and we know that that's a really bad idea. So having the idea that it's my job as a man to not only check my behavior, but make sure the people around me, make sure my sons understand what good boundaries are, and that's how we start to take care of this problem a little bit. But we see a lot of trauma in these men too. Again, they've got their own histories. Again, they've had poor modeling, and they've learned to be exploitive, and sometimes it manifests in really hurtful ways towards the survivors and the victims.
And you talked a little bit about bystander intervention and using that as an intervention working with perpetrators as a way to prevent recidivism or behaving violently again. Could you talk a little bit more about how that your answer informs the prevention work that you do, and maybe also talk about preventing before somebody offends as well, and how this might inform that?
Yeah, so I mean, the bystander movement is not for people typically that are perpetrators, right, but for just all men. But I think it's a great opportunity to start having those dialogues. Like, is this okay? You know, like, what is good behavior? What is not good behavior? But you're right, we've extended that into kind of taking this universalized view with even people who have offended to say, hey, what are we going to do about this? Is this the kind of world we want to continue to live in? And I want to be clear, there's different sort of typologies of sex offenders. I want to be clear about, like, people will sexually assault or sexually offend for very different reasons and very different ways. And so it's not sort of casting a broad net when we talk about this stuff, but just to allow people, and we do this in all kinds of counseling types of interventions, where we help people to see that they're connected to other people. There's a great TED talk that talks about addiction that says that the opposite of, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, but it's connection. And I think that's a really interesting way to think about this, is once we allow us to connect to other people and we get close to those people and we can empathize with those people, we're much less likely to hurt those people. And so having that degree of connection is important. So in counseling these offenders, we will work with that and help them to get connected. I didn't mention, a lot of these folks are very socially isolated. They do not have good social skills. Again, they've had poor boundaries and modeling, and so they don't have the ability to connect in a healthy way with someone. Mm-hmm. So teaching them, that's really social skills, ways to connect with people, and then they get their social needs and needs for intimacy met in healthy, normative ways rather than abusive ways.
I love this focus on positive sex education, this focus on intimacy. You know, cis men are excluded from being able to be given permission to be intimate, and all men are experience that. And I think focusing on prevention methods that are focused around positive interventions are really exciting. So speaking of exciting prevention methods, can we each talk about one prevention method we're particularly excited about?
Well, I think before we move into that, I just mm-hmm. want to go back briefly and talking about what else do we see in our community that influences the way that we normalize sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And then that will lead into the prevention Perfect. Conversation. So thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, if I were to ask the group right now to raise your hands, I'm not going to. I'm not asking you to disclose. But if I were to ask you to consider how many of you have played Grand Theft Auto or have watched a movie where it's incredibly objectifying towards women or violent towards women, and or music that consistently talks about rape or sex as something that is entitled, right? It's just a part of the way that we consume things, right? So it's a part of our music, it's a part of our entertainment. And so that's also a part of what we as citizens have to consider, that we're buying into these messages. So why are we surprised when we see violence, when violence is literally a part of everyday existence in terms of what we are consuming as individuals that are buying this entertainment? So we also have to remember that our buying power can help change the way that marketers, producers, that individuals are creating product for us. Because right now what there is a supply and demand. We are demanding that there be this product, and they are supplying us with things that are saying it's okay to create violence against women. It's okay to have things where a woman is raped and then there is no conversation about healing and being empowered. There is no conversation around what happens in the aftermath. And we really need to start creating more spaces where that is a focus, because this happens in our community. Utah is one of the states that has a very high rate of sexual violence. 1 in 3 women will be a victim of sexual violence in her lifetime. 1 in 6 men. So even though at the national average, it's 1 in 33. So Utah, when we talk about sexual assault and rape, that is the only violent crime that has a higher index than any other state. So we have to look at this. It's a conversation that has to happen because it's happening in our communities. So the when we're talking about prevention, we need to have authentic conversations about what sexuality and consent looks like, because even what we're having right now in schools, it's not happening. We have a client in our office that they were charged with an allegation of sexual violence, and they were just like, nope, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't rape her. I did not do it. But then we started to have a little bit more of a conversation about what happened. And they were just like, well, yeah, they said no, but you know that no means yes. So they really wanted it, right? So who's teaching this individual about what healthy sexuality is? Because it's not their parents and it's not in schools. So they're getting the information from somewhere, and these forums are not well-informed. So that's, I think, part of when we're talking about what's exciting about prevention, is that now we're having the dialogues and now we're creating the spaces where people can actually feel vulnerable and exposed and say, this is what I want to know about sexuality. Mm-hmm. This is what I want to know about my own sexuality, my own experience in being able to navigate this this journey. And so that's what I think is really beneficial about this movement.
And to further elaborate on that, just because someone said yes once and it was consensual doesn't mean that you have the right to not ask again. And I think a lot of times people get confused about that. And I'm talking about whoever's in that relationship. It goes both ways.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something we tend to forget, that just because somebody said yes yesterday doesn't mean they're going to say yes tomorrow when you wake up.
I think what Nubia was saying about conversations is important. That's really what I think, that's maybe the common thread that we're all talking about, is this started as a hashtag #MeToo conversation in some ways, and we need to continue to have that conversation, and men need to have these conversations, and parents need to have these conversations, and we've got to create opportunities to really dialogue about it. It's interesting because as human beings, we talk about everything. We communicate all the time. We have this elaborate language we've developed, but there's still this one area about sexuality or relationships or boundaries that we struggle to have conversations about. So that's important to just continue to do that. And maybe that's the evolution, is this turns into an ongoing conversation.
And there again, men have to be comfortable with women. As we saw Tony Robbins, is that how you say his name, Robinson?
Robbins.
Yeah. On, you know, all the my Twitter feed. And I was thinking of even some of my colleagues were like, I don't know if I want to have a female intern. And it's like, really? Are you serious? So you're going to not give a young woman an opportunity because of a Me Too hashtag. And so maybe you need to reevaluate yourself and look in the mirror and see who the problem really is.
I mean, that's victim blaming, right? You know,
that's
a powerful man saying, "Oh, I'm afraid of a woman with a lot less power because of this." What I think is so interesting, I guess, reflecting personally, as I do my work and things like that, men are just not comfortable giving up their power. And what happens when we have awareness-raising movements like this is that we're forced to re-examine that. And maybe men are a little uncomfortable. I hope that he is a little. I think he should be thinking about not whether or not he wants.
This was several men, not one.
Right. I haven't followed this. But I think that that's a good exercise for men to say, okay, you need to be a little less comfortable with having all the power in the room. And you need to have opportunities to give that away and be comfortable with that and sit with that.
And I think we see that across all power-holding groups and oppressors, feeling really uncomfortable losing even the tiniest bit of their power. Even when we see people gaining a voice, that somehow feels oppressive to the ones who hold the power. When we see a little bit of a tip, the scales tipping a little bit in a different direction, that feels like the weight of oppression to those who hold the power and have it all. Which kind of leads into my next question about making the Me Too movement and coming forward more accessible for more people. We see that there may be a little bit more support for people coming forward who have a great deal of wealth privilege or a bunch of other privileges. How do we make this more accessible and inclusive so that everybody can come forward who wants to?
And I think that's the key issue, because we've seen, you know, at a national level, some people lose their jobs or be disciplined. But when you look at the everyday person, the institution is still protecting the alleged perpetrator. Mm-hmm. And that's why people don't speak out, because it's with sexual assault. It's the victim shaming. Mm-hmm. It's the victim blaming again. And it's the doubting. It's, you know, what we ran a resolution. I ran that resolution in 2015, Start by Believing. And it's Start by Believing, not Start by Ending. Mm-hmm. And I think people need to validate how someone's feeling. And if someone feels uncomfortable with someone, maybe you don't, but maybe that person has, that person does, and that's okay. And there's a reason behind that, and you should trust that. And we don't do that enough, and we still protect, I think, as an institution, the alleged perpetrator. And we see this even at the highest office, where there have been multiple women that have come out, and they're still doubted, and they're still degraded in the news media and in public.
Right. And I think when we, once again, kind of look at not only the critiques, but what we can do better, we need to center the voices of the marginalized communities who are dealing and facing with this form of oppression every single day of their lives, but they don't have the social capital, they don't have the backing from their organizations, or even just societally. They are not believed in the same ways, and they don't have the services, they don't have access to services that are culturally relevant. So there's a lot of gaps that still exist for individuals to feel like they can come. So let's say that there is an individual who is undocumented and who identifies as LGBTQ and who is non-English speaking. If they were to walk into a police department, will they find someone that possibly looks like them, that will understand their background, that will understand their culture, that will know what their narrative is and what their fears are in trusting the system that we currently have in place? And when we talk about the system in terms of prosecution, prosecutors also need training and having a better understanding about sexual violence dynamics, domestic violence dynamics, working with juvenile offenders, right? Because these juvenile offenders, that is what I specifically work in every single day. They're different than adult offenders, and they have to be treated differently. And so, because these are the individuals that will eventually grow up to be the students that are in our high school, in our educational institutions, in our workforce. And so what do we do to also have a rehabilitative and restorative lens? Because we cannot just isolate these individuals. They are a part of our community. So we need to center the voices of the marginalized. We need to equip individuals who are service providers to have a better understanding of culturally relevant services that must be had. And we need to make sure that there are spaces for people to feel safe to disclose their narrative with communities that can create solidarity with them.
But we have to remember, just because someone looks like you doesn't mean they're going to be sympathetic or, you know, understand you as well. And in 2017, with the bill to mandate the testing of all sexual assault kits, we also did funding, ongoing funding for prosecutors to be trained in domestic violence and sexual assault. And there was some legislation we passed this session on trauma-informed training for people who service providers. So we're moving along that direction. Are we moving as fast as I'd like? No, but we're slowly changing that that perspective, hopefully. But we have a whole new group of people coming in, so I'm going to have to do a lot of re-education.
I was so pleased to see the trauma-informed, the bill for the trauma-informed training, because that's just really important. As a society, we need to be understanding of the impact of trauma and be responsive to that and sensitive to that. And I agree with everything that's been said. The only thing I would add to that is that we need to make sure that people who suffer these abuses have access to good treatment, culturally sensitive treatment, of course, but there's still a large portion of our population that, even if they have insurance, they don't have good mental health coverage, they don't know how to find a good provider, and so we've got to create opportunities for folks to have easy access to that, to make a call. I mean, imagine being the survivor of a rape and having to call the Rape Recovery Center and three different places before you can get in to see a counselor. I know that I've talked to lots of survivors who said, I couldn't go through that process, and I couldn't tell my story to five different people. I just needed to see a good therapist so I could work through this. And so we need to create systems of care and opportunities for treatment that are more accessible to the folks that we're caring about.
I was wondering if we could shift gears a little bit and talk about colleges and universities, since we are on a college campus right now. And I'd love to hear some perspectives on what colleges and universities can do to prevent the occurrence of sexual assault on campus and provide better responses to reports.
I would really love to see as part of orientation that during your week-long session that I believe most students have to go through before they begin their college semester, that every single individual is trained on what sexual assault is, what consent is, what does it look like if harassment occurs, who to report, who is your go-to, what are the services that are available. I want to highlight some key individuals that have done this work for a very long time. There's Jody, there's Rachel, Dara. So we've got some very experienced individuals that can provide assistance and empowerment to individuals that experience this at college, but there needs to be a priority where these conversations are had. There also needs to be, I think, solidarity with the groups and the community groups with students, that this is also something where they have the Start By Believing every April. They host an awareness campaign where there's also an opportunity during October where it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month that they're able to have conversations. There's a lot of individuals who have experienced either DV in their life as children or who have experienced it in a dating relationship, but they didn't know what to call it because they didn't know what it was until we're actually having these dialogues. So creating space, I think, is going to be critical for college campuses to ensure that students feel safe and empowered to disclose if this happens.
I agree. So starting the conversation right at orientation, but I think as a faculty member here at the university, we have an obligation to create that safe space in our classrooms so that people can feel like that conversation can continue. And then I think forums like this, I think as a public institution, we need to not only educate people, but keep this on, not just during Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but throughout the year, that this is an issue all the time and create opportunities for people to have conversations again. And I think, and again, I would be remiss if I didn't say we do need to focus on men and bring men into that conversation, especially with the bystander movement. I think that's such a powerful thing, and I've known lots of men, including myself, that have gone through that training, and it can be a powerful thing that brings men together in solidarity to care for the people that most of us, all of us have women that we care about, and we care about each other and helping to understand our impact, how we can impact that and what we can do about it could be really good, and again, it starts that conversation that's also important.
And as a policymaker, I'd like to hear from staff and students of what they feel would be the best solution to address that on college campuses, because I have lots of colleagues who have great ideas where they lower the age of concealed carry to 18 so that women can protect themselves against sexual assault, which I didn't vote for, reporting, making that, taking away that confidentiality and reporting that directly to law enforcement. And so I would like to know kind of your thoughts on that and what we can do as policymakers to support you, because a lot of times we have these bright ideas of what we think would be best, but it's what we think. It's not what actually happens. It's not actually what people that we're trying to impact think.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today we are airing a forum focused on sexual assault awareness held on April 11th, 2018. For the final segment, Billy Palmer, producer with the local radio station KRCL, helped moderate questions from the audience.
You know, I've enjoyed this conversation quite a bit, and I wanted to maybe start with a question, and then we can get to some questions. We have a lot of men in the room, so you have sort of an opportunity. Because usually when you begin to talk about ending rape culture, the room fills up with a bunch of women, and everybody talks about how we protect ourselves, and then we leave. And maybe perhaps part of this conversation should be, in this whole Me Too movement, in this whole era of Me Too, we should hope that it's going to be, where do men, in a sense, fit into the Me Too movement, and what is the Me Too of men? Because we understand that if most women, almost all women, or if not every woman has a Me Too experience, then probably every man has a Me Too or I did that too experiences as well. And what leads a man to go too far, to take it too far? I would assume that most men, and I want to get your thoughts on this, that most men have some Me Too moments of themselves. So let's say, if I've been on a date, what are my friends going to say if I didn't get a kiss or didn't get sex? If I've cried, what do other people tell me about being too feminine, you know, and crying, being too sensitive, if I didn't catch a ball, all of those things. We grow with so many of our own Me Toos that we are defeminized, in a sense. And we are taught to see, perhaps, that women, or being a woman, or being feminine is a weak thing or a bad thing. I wanted to get your thoughts on that, and where men could find themselves in the Me Too movement with that sort of as a backdrop.
Well, I'll start as the guy on the panel. We talked a little bit about that, but I think that it is important that it becomes a human issue and not just a women's issue, and that we have these conversations early on with men. I'm a firm believer that it's, you know, one of the things I do research in is domestic violence offender treatment, batter treatment. Well, the dirty little secret is it doesn't work. We send men to domestic violence treatment, and the research is very clear that it doesn't change their attitudes. It doesn't change how they use power and control with their partners. And the reason is because we're getting to these folks too late. You know, that socialization has to start early. We have to have conversations with kids that counter the mainstream media messages. I'm terrified about letting my kids watch what's happening in politics and in the media a lot of times, because they're getting a message that reinforces this masculine power grid that's terrible. So we have to have those conversations earlier, and then we've got to teach men that vulnerability is power, as our friend Brené Brown teaches us, right? And so I think to be able to have those conversations, that it's okay to cry, and as adults, we need to model that.
And it does. It really lends itself to having a conversation about redefining masculinity. What does it mean to be a man in our society? Because currently there's a lot of things that are attached to that: being strong, being dominant, being aggressive, being in control. And you know, we don't celebrate men who are nurturing. We don't celebrate men who are more of the caretakers or who are gentle and compassionate. You know, there's that saying of like, good guys finish last. Why is that? What is it about that we celebrate, as opposed to really being able to push against that narrative and saying like, we need good men, but we need to teach that from very young ages. So, you know, my call to action for individuals who are present is that if you have time, mentor a young man, mentor a young woman, step in and be able to help model what healthy humanity is, right? Wanting to be invested and engaged in a dialogue and conversation in a movement towards eradicating sexual violence, being the person that is going to be the change agent in every space that you hold, because we need those individuals that say, I see it, but instead of turning a blind eye, you're choosing to say enough is enough.
And that leads to I can use a personal story. I think that sometimes it's easier to do that. My son's a student up here. I won't name him because he gets mad when I do that. But before him and his friends are going to go out, I'll offer to take them to dinner. And they already know what the conversation's going to be about. And I'm like, okay, where are you going? What you're doing? And then we talk about what consent is. And they're used to this conversation. I've been having this conversation with them since they were in ninth grade. But it's really emphasizing how important it is to what is consent, and how do they participate in it, and how do I participate in that? And so we have these conversations all the time, and he rolls his eyes. But when he was, you know, I told him, when you're ready to talk about sex, let me know. And he's like, okay, Mom. And, you know, we were having these conversations since he was five. And his junior year, he'd gotten back from a trip because he has a lot of privileges I didn't have as a child. And he's like, Mom, I think I'm ready to go to Planned Parenthood. And so he went to Planned Parenthood, when he finished up that talk, I'm like, do you want to talk about it? He goes, not with you. But the point is I gave him those options. And as you go, you know, finish your college career, and some of you might have children now, it's important to have those conversations. So it kind of starts at home. And so what I had to do is change patterns that I grew up with and that his dad grew up with. His father was in foster care. His mom was always being beaten up by his stepdad. So that's all his dad saw. And so his own father doesn't have the best communication skills. And so, you know, my poor kid came into these two, and a lot of us have those same issues in our own families. But, you know, how do we talk about that? How do we change those patterns? And that's what I put on everyone, because it's not just about sexual assault. It's about these unhealthy patterns.
Any questions?
Great presentation. It's a real honor to be here with all the U students. I would like to know, and I don't want to get politics into this, but you've talked very positively about issues, opportunities to change, house bills, that type of thing. We have in Washington right now a horrible, horrible person who is creating maybe some problems accommodating some of the movement beyond Me Too that you're I don't want to use the word promoting because it's all very very well defined. I'm concerned as being slightly older than these folks, but I'm still concerned about the influence that this person has, particularly on the efforts that you're doing, and to a certain degree, to my friends behind me.
To clarify the question, are you asking what's to be done about the sort of excusing of me of some of these problematic things by our, or dare not say the word, but President of the United States?
Yeah.
Is that your question?
My question is, after you folks have presented what you have today, obviously working from a lot of experience and knowledge, what kind of influence, behaving like he does, both history and even present day, what kind of effect is it having on not just the Me Too movement, but what you folks are trying to develop?
I mean, unfortunately, I think it reinforces the old institutions and the patriarchy and excuses a lot of this behavior. I'm very concerned as well. And as I mentioned, it creates opportunities. I mean, when I see things like that I disagree with, that are affront to things I believe in, and I know that other people are seeing that, that creates a teaching moment for me and my children. So I have conversations with my sons about what they hear on the news or what they see. And then I also teach them to be political. And I say, you better call your representatives and you better vote and you better know who your delegates are. And making sure that we don't feel powerless, but also starting at home and doing what we can do to sort of give a different message. So, and it really emphasizes the point why we have to have those conversations. Because if we don't, they're going to hear that through the media all the time.
We've seen the rise of incivility since he's been in office. And I felt it this last session, too. It was a different kind of feeling. It was more mean-spirited at times. But I also agree with you. It's an important time to have a conversation. And I serve with a lot of people who are big Donald Trump fans. And, you know, I try to have those conversations with them. And I you know, a lot of times we communicate, but we talk at people. We don't talk to them. We don't listen to each other. And it takes a lot of patience to listen to someone, especially when you don't agree with them, and to hear what they're actually telling you. And so I had a lot of those moments this last session because I had to understand why we were going to have Donald Trump Highway. And it didn't happen, thank God. But my point is there's a reason why people are attracted to him. And it frightens me. But why are people attracted to that? And that's what I try to kind of find out and try to find ways in which to have a conversation with people who like that tactic and tell them why it's bullying. It's hard. I don't really have an answer.
I think that we need to remember that this was a person that was voted into office. So if you see something that you disagree with, then this is really our call to action to you all to say, get involved, bring awareness, post things, engage in dialogue, challenge behavior, challenge the culture that you're seeing and that you're witnessing. Be the person that models by example. Set clear boundaries. Even if you're the sole person, because I have to tell you, this can be a very lonely, lonely path, to be the sole voice in a space where people think it's okay to say a rape joke, it's okay to say a homophobic joke, it's okay to say a racist joke. And I'm talking beyond just sexual violence, because if you allow one form of oppression, then you allow all. It's intersectional. And so recognizing that what we see currently happening and developing in the national level and on the political level of our nation is terrifying for those in the movement who want to end this form of violence. So what we need to do is we need to educate individuals that maybe were in the dark before about what this really means, about how this is attached to power and control, and how we collectively and unified as a movement, as a community, can ask and demand from those empowered to hear us and to change the way things are done. Because doing things just because it's always been done that way is just not enough anymore. And we have to push against that. So again, you are now in college. This is where you're going to engage in critical thinking conversations. You're going to be challenged, and we are asking you to challenge the way that things are done, because the status quo, unfortunately, has been oppressive, has silenced marginalized communities, and has consistently given powers to those that are at the top, although it never trickles down to the larger majority. So get involved.
We have a lot of students here. We'd love to hear from some students.
Yeah, so I'm a senior here at the university. I'm going to be graduating at the end of this month, so really excited about that. Some of us, and I'm not going to try to speak for everybody here, but I know myself, this is something that I feel strongly about, equipping people with the tools to deal with this kind of thing, both people that have experienced this and people that are perpetrating it. We need to equip people with these tools. Some of us want to make careers out of this kind of thing. Some of us want to be that involved with it, but we don't know how. We don't know how to get into this. We want to spend our time doing this. We also need to pay our bills. So how do you do that?
So there are several options, right? So you have an individual that's working the front lines right now with individuals who offend to try to rehabilitate, but also bringing awareness to how we can change behaviors. You have an individual like myself who's working at the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, where I'm a part of the training team that equips frontline individuals who are providing the services. You have individuals who are changing policies, right? So there's various tracks. You can be a professor that creates a curriculum solely and specifically on challenging this form of infrastructure of mindsets and shifting culture. Then you can also be an individual that responds with the Rape Recovery Center, where if there is a sexual assault survivor, they are the ones that respond to the hospital to provide comfort and solace to the individuals that endured one of the most horrific moments of their life. There are several things that you can do. So I'd be happy to mentor, to go to coffee, to chat with you, to help maybe create a plan of action of how to move forward. But volunteering is also one of the things I'm going to encourage you all to do. The Rape Recovery Center has a team. Unified Police Department has a team so that you can be a volunteer to respond to domestic violence situations so you can help survivors. And then also, if you want to be a mentor for individuals at the Boys and Girls Club or in your church communities, faith-based communities have to be a part of this conversation. So if you're a part of that, please make sure that you tell them, hey, our congregation needs to be taught about this. Would you be willing to host a training? And give us a call, because we'd be happy to step in. But there's a lot of things you can do.
And the one thing, again, I'll point out is not all us politicians are bad. I think you know, I'm a politician. I hate when people say, I'm not a politician. I'm there to represent the people. No, you're a politician, because in order to get elected, you have to be a politician too. And what I really encourage people to do, if you have the opportunity, if you're not an aspiring citizen and you are a citizen, is to vote. I mean, that's where it really boils down to, is if everyone in the state of Utah would vote, the Utah state legislature wouldn't look like it does now. And so I challenge everyone who can vote to vote. I don't care if you vote Republican, Green Party, Libertarian, Democrat, just vote. I think that's a really important piece. And as you as an individual can change things, and I always believe people can change, again, if you have honest conversations. And so I think what people, if you walk out with anything here when we're talking about this, is like, what power do you have to influence someone else to change patterns and behaviors or misconceptions? Because you can. There's a lobbyist that I spent a lot of time with, and he described Latinos in a certain way. And I'm like, no, you don't use that word. You use undocumented, or you use aspiring citizen. This is why I use these words. And so now whenever somebody, and I educated him and I listened to him and why he said that. And now anytime he's somewhere at an event and someone uses a term that they're not supposed to, he educates them and they'll listen to him more than me. But my point is we all have power here in this room too. And we have power to influence other people who can influence other people.
I think you've said it all. I'd get involved. There's lots of opportunities to volunteer, especially, I mean, one of the great things about being a college student is you can do internships and you can get credit for it. Sometimes you can get a stipend, things like that. So that's always a great idea. And as Nubia said, I'm happy to talk to you more about that. There's lots of opportunities to work with kids in the child welfare system or in the juvenile justice system. These kids, these young people are very at high risk for abuse. And so that's another area to get involved.
Thanks. Please give a big round of applause to our panelists.
That's Rob Butters, professor in the College of Social Work at the University of Utah and director of the Utah Criminal Justice Center. You can hear the full discussion on this forum dedicated to sexual assault awareness and prevention on our website, kcpw.org. Again, this forum was held on April 11th, 2018, and was co-sponsored by the Center for Student Wellness and the ASUU. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.